In addition, he is an accomplished mountain climber, and if you go on the web, you'll find as many pages of his mountaineering exploits as you will of his physics exploits.
Not quite.
Almost as many. Today, he's going to speak on the problem of quantum gravity.
Thank you. So it's great to be back at PI. I feel like a frequent visitor here. It's wonderful to see the place grow. So I recognize this is a diverse audience, and I'm going to give a talk that I hope is interesting to and perhaps provocative to those who have their interest in string theory, loop quantum gravity, supergravity, cosmology, or more general physical issues. Of course, this is a colloquium, but I'm bearing in mind this is a colloquium at Perimeter, and that's different than your usual colloquium. Since many people in the audience are greater experts on a number of the things I'm going to talk about than I am. Well, so let's go ahead and get started on the question of the problems of quantum gravity. And of course, that's been a time-honored subject here. Oh, get the remote working. So the problems in quantum gravity are, multiple. And the ones that you hear about perhaps the most are, for example, the issues of the ultraviolet divergences and the non-renormalizability of quantum gravity. And, of course, the problems of singularities that you encounter in cosmology or in black holes, even in more general settings. But there are other problems as well that are, to some of you, probably less familiar. There are the problems associated with time and defining gauge invariant observables, the question of the high energy behavior of the theory, and I'll say more about this, and also the conundrums of inflationary cosmology. And so, in fact, I'm going to focus on this last three, the last three problems on this list, and discuss their fundamental importance and linkages between them. And in some sense, I think these might be more important problems even than these first two, which are common, as I mentioned, common foci. So starting very generally, we should consider in physics, at the start, what are sharp physical questions? And you might naively guess, like in field theory, that in gravity, we should be computing things like expectation values of fields, either scalar fields or the metric. This, of course, is the kind of quantity we compute in field theory, precisely. But in gravity, those kinds of quantities are not good things to compute, in some sense, because they're not gauge invariant. And I'll explain this more later, but the basic idea is that the gauge invariance of gravity is, of course, diffeomorphisms, coordinate transformations. And a local observable, like the value of a field at a point, will change under such a diffeomorphism. So that's not a gauge invariant quantity, and that's bad. So if we want to figure out what we should be computing in formulating sharp physical questions, we need to have another approach to the problem of observables. We'd like something that is approximately local, at least, because certainly in cosmology we're looking at very sort of local features of the quantum state. And the basic approach to that, it appears, should be relational, that you localize relative to the features of the state. So this is a way of attacking or setting up sharp questions in the cosmological context in particular. Another thing you can focus on is the S matrix. And actually, for this talk, I will begin with the S matrix, because conceptually that's a little easier to set up. And this problem of observables is more challenging, and I'll return to that later in the talk. So let's start with the S matrix and the basic ideas in formulating the gravitational S matrix. So first of all, Minkowski space is an approximate solution of quantum gravity. We observe that the radius of curvature of the universe is much, much larger than, say, the Planck length. There are excitations about this vacuum, or near vacuum, which correspond to particles, electrons, photons, quarks, etc. And their asymptotic states are described by their momenta, at least in the approximation where we're dealing with exact Minkowski space. And then, of course, once you have that set up, you can scatter asymptotic multiparticle states and, say, have two particles in and two out, or two to n scattering, or other more complicated processes. And so the question is, formulating this basic quantity, the S matrix, in the context of gravity, basically what we're after is this set of amplitudes, quantum amplitudes, to go from some initial state with some incoming momenta to some final state with some outgoing momenta. And you might, for example, consider the quantum amplitudes for, say, two particles scattering at very high energies and forming a black hole, which then Hawking evaporates, and so you have many outgoing Hawking quanta. And so one of the basic points is that an S matrix like this is a very powerful and sharp way to summarize our ignorance of a theory. And if you're in doubt of that, let's remind ourselves of some history. The simply study of properties of S matrices in general, in fact, led to the discovery of string theory. Well, Mr. Veneziano wrote down his amplitude long ago based on thinking about general features of S matrices, and then it was discovered that that S matrix describes strings. So this is a very powerful way to operate in general. And moreover, there are many possible candidate theories of quantum gravity, and an S matrix is a sort of a testing ground for those theories. Any theory of quantum gravity should give us a means to approximately calculate the S matrix, with one small footnote there for those who are a little bit more sophisticated. But in particular, one regime which I'd like to focus on is the ultra-Planckian regime. When you're scattering particles at energies, center of mass energies far above the Planck scale, and here I'm going to talk about the Planck scale in general dimension, d dimensions. And so MD is the d-dimensional Planck mass. And one of the reasons we do that is, for example, in certain sort of, well, string scenarios or more general scenarios, this d-dimensional Planck scale actually could be as low as a TeV. So if we're very, very lucky, we could actually observe this kind of phenomenon at the LHC. So that's one reason to think more generally about the dimension, or to avoid certain what appear to be trivial infrared problems. So here, in the context of very high energy scattering, we encounter some serious issues that really test at the foundations of the problem of reconciling quantum mechanics and gravity. And in particular, here, critical issue, apparently, is unitarity, and I'm going to say more about that as we go. Now, you might say, if you approach the Planck regime because of this problem of non-renormalizability, which I first mentioned, you have big enough problems that you might not even be able to say anything about these ultra-high energies. But let's ask a more refined question. Let's think about scattering as a function of energy and distance probed or impact parameter. So here's a plot of the two. And, of course, there's a quantum limit on that. For a given energy, you can only probe down to a certain impact parameter. And what we're doing as we go to higher and higher energies in scattering experiments is basically going down this line and probing shorter and shorter distances. And, of course, we believe that once we hit the Planck energy and, correspondingly, the Planck distance, we're going to run into all these troubles with non-renormalizability. And the theory has to change in some way. Maybe it involves string theory, maybe the ideas of loop quantum gravity. But it's very hard to pass this barrier. But there's a different regime we can consider. In fact, the tree-level approximation to scattering, the Born approximation, is good all the way out here and out to very high energies at sufficiently high impact parameters. In fact, the Earth-Moon scattering problem is one with very high energies and, of course, large impact parameters. So we're in the regime where here, where we have still some control, even if we're at very high energies. And it suggests that this ultra-high energy problem is not hopeless and, indeed, is very interesting. So that's what I have in mind, is working at very high energies and lowering the impact parameter and thinking about the physics. let's clean the diagram up a little bit. So initially, we have scattering described by just exchange of gravitons, single graviton exchange. And then once you go to small enough impact parameters, you have multiple graviton exchange, so-called iconal scattering. I'll say a little bit more about the details of that, but for small enough impact parameters, and we'll see where this comes from, this energy dependence, where you get into the iconal region. You have iconal scattering, which we have a fair degree of control over. It's closely related to the classical approximation. And then as you lower the impact parameter further, ultimately you expect to get into a regime that classically would correspond to black hole formation. And so this is how we would like to explore the ultra-high energy regime, beginning at large impact parameters. And we do encounter certain loop diagrams. Actually, there's another region here in string theory I'm not going to talk about, but I'll, in case people ask about that dotted line, I'll refer back to it, but otherwise ignore it. But in any case, we do encounter loop diagrams that we have to think about in the context of quantum gravity, say when we talk about the iconal amplitudes. And you might say, well, can we even make any sense out of those still because of this issue of non-renormalizability? And the basic message, or at least a basic message of the first part of this talk, is the following. This issue of non-renormalizability really is a short distance issue. We really seem to have deeper problems with the theory at long distances. And this is something we can examine in the context, for example, of candidate regulators we have for the theory. We can imagine just a crude loop momentum cutoff, but also more sophisticated things like supergravity, or think of string theory as a regulator of the ultraviolet divergences. And this message seems to come through, I believe, loud and clear when you think carefully about it. In fact, to see that we're dealing in long distances, let's consider some particularly simple loop amplitudes, namely the iconal amplitudes that I was just had just drawn on the earlier slide. So I need to explain these carefully. So we're thinking of scattering as a function of the center of mass energy and, say, momentum transfer, Q. Often we work in terms of the Mandelstam parameters, E squared and minus Q squared. And these iconal diagrams basically correspond to summing up the tree amplitudes for single graviton exchange. And those take the familiar form. They grow like the center of mass energy to the fourth, and then over the, here's just the propagator of the intermediate graviton state carrying some momentum ki. So those are the tree amplitudes, and we just sew a bunch of those together to get the iconal amplitudes. That's the basic idea. In order to do that, it's easiest to basically work in terms of the Fourier transform of the tree level amplitudes, the single graviton exchange amplitudes. So that Fourier transform is pictured here. You work in terms of the perpendicular to the center of mass momentum as the momentum transfer, and introduce a variable which basically is the vector quantity corresponding to the impact parameter. So you have this Fourier transform, basically, of the tree level amplitude, which we call the iconal phase. It has this dependence on the center of mass energy and the transverse separation. And the bottom line is, when you sew these amplitudes together to get the full loop amplitude, you get something of this form, where it's just a power of the iconal phase, and then you Fourier transform back from the impact parameter variables to the momentum variables. So it's a simple expression. And in fact, it's so simple that a nice thing happens. Here we've written down the expression for an n loop amplitude. And if we sum them up, we see that we have something that is a very simple power series that, in fact, exponentiates. So the sum over these exchanges gives this exponential, and that is the iconal approximation to the scattering amplitude. And again, I've reproduced the iconal phase. Now, one immediate objection, coming back to the short versus long distance question, is that, in fact, this expression looks pretty singular. It looks very singular at short distances, because if we go back to the expanded form, we have a 1 over x perp to a very large power if we expand out the exponential. and then integrate it over x perp. So it looks like we have an expression that is very, very singular at short distances. And in fact, we've made it even more singular than it started out being by making some of the approximations we made in deriving this iconal amplitude that I've skipped over a few of the details. And so you might say, well, this is crazy. How can these amplitudes even make any sense whatsoever? And we have to worry about all the short distance issues. And that viewpoint is, in fact, completely wrong. Once you have the summed up amplitude, this amplitude, in fact, has a saddle point for large energies. And that saddle point corresponds to very long distances at large energies and small momentum transfers. You just see the saddle point directly by varying with respect to x plus. And so the moral of that is that the dominant configurations here really do correspond to long distance interactions and are not sensitive to these short distance problems. In fact, there's a toy integral that illustrates this nicely. So again, here's this iconal amplitude. Let's just take some of the basic features of this, an integral over an impact parameter, and then something of the general form of the iconal phase, 1 over b squared with some coupling constant. Let's just think about this toy integral with some short distance cutoff because of the bad behavior at b equals 0. And clearly, if we take and expand out that exponential in a power series, we get something that looks terrible. We get higher and higher powers of 1 over b, which are going to give more and more divergent terms when you integrate, higher and higher powers of lambda, which is the inverse of the short distance cutoff. But on the other hand, this is an integral that you can just plug into Mathematica and, in fact, do by that or other means. It has a closed form expression in terms of the exponential integral. And moreover, it's an expression that is nicely behaved as lambda goes to infinity. So, in fact, it doesn't have sensitive dependence on the short distance cutoff. It's just that when you try to expand it this way, it looks like you have very bad short distance behavior. So this illustrates the same kind of behavior that the iconal amplitudes have, that the short distance dynamics doesn't matter, even though naively in a perturbation expansion it looks like it does. Another way of viewing this is what we call momentum fractionation. If you think about, again, this expression for the iconal amplitudes, this exponential, if you're working at a given energy and impact parameter, this exponential series will be dominated with the term with a power which is of order the size of the quantity in the exponent. And I should mention here, this is where we find the dividing line between the Born and iconal regions, is where the iconal phase is of order 1. That's where you basically have to keep more than the first order term in the series. But coming back to this, for even higher energies or smaller impact parameters, the dominant term is the nth term in the sum, the n-loop contribution given by the value of the iconal phase. And you can ask, what is a typical exchange momentum if you have a total momentum exchanged, which is q? Well, it's q divided by the number of rungs in your ladder. And that comes out to be 1 over the impact parameter. So for large impact parameters, or let's put it this way. For large energy and even very large momentum transfers, you're working effectively at long distances. The individual momentum transfers are quite small. They're of order 1 over the impact parameter. So this largely justifies, this in the preceding discussion, the long distance nature of the scattering. And one can illustrate this, if you're suspicious of this whole story, in an approach where we control the loop amplitudes quite well. That's supergravity. Of course, there are various exact expressions for, say, one loop and higher loop amplitudes. I'll just quickly reproduce those here. There are some people, of course, who work on these here. And in fact, the full gravity amplitudes are written in terms of effectively scalar integrals that are finite and look, indeed, something like the iconal diagrams I was just drawing. So these are finite. The supergravity is giving an effective cutoff of order the center of mass energy. But the basic message I want to convey is you have here a nice finite expression which is approximately these one-loop iconal amplitudes, say, in the one-loop case that I've been talking about, plus terms of order momentum transfer over energy to a power. plus cutoff-dependent stuff. So you really manage to match the story I was just telling precisely onto a place where you have a nice regulated calculation for the loop diagrams. And this extends to two loops as well. I won't go through the details of this, but likewise, you can check that you have a nice match to this long-distance iconal story with the two-loop supergravity amplitudes. Now, this raises another question. We know that supergravity has a lot of other particles in it besides the graviton. What is their role in this whole story besides effectively regulating the short-distance behavior? And so this illustrates the fact that, in fact, the fact that these don't matter in a significant way, what we call graviton dominance, at very high energies and long distances, the dominant exchange, the dominant force, is that of gravity. And that's because the gravitational coupling grows most rapidly with the energy. The coupling of a given field grows with the energy to its helicity. And so in the regime we're talking about, gravity dominates over, say, exchange of gravitini and other states in the supergravity multiplet. So the behavior we're talking about, in fact, should be relatively generic to any theory of gravity. And this momentum fractionation has also some very important consequences, which I associated with this lack of probing short distances, which I want to mention. One approach to quantum gravity is this idea of asymptotic safety. And what this story is telling us, momentum fractionation, is that the high energy scattering apparently only probes the value of Newton's constant at momentum transfers which are quite small. So in fact, it's hard to see how to operationally probe the high momentum transfer region where asymptotic safety is supposed to make relevant statements. As just a different way of saying it, high energy scattering, the problem of high energy scattering is largely insensitive to whatever changes you make in the ultraviolet, for example, by introducing higher excited string states and so on. And then one final point I'd like to make is that previous incomplete theories that we've encountered in nature, for example, the four Fermi interaction, massive vector bosons, and so on, led to situations where we had a link between a problem of non-renormalizability and a problem of unitarity. But here, in the context of gravity, because of some of the unique features, it looks like these two kinds of problems disassociate. They're quite distinct in a certain way, which I'll explain further. I think that's an important observation. So to see this, let's explore the problem of unitarity in quantum gravity further. We'll come back to our scattering diagram and think about scattering again at very high energies as we lower the impact parameter into the strong gravity region. And this power law dependence is given by the impact parameter, which corresponds to the Schwarzschild radius that you would have for a black hole with a mass equal to the center of mass energy. And so in d dimensions, that gives you this power e to the 1 over d minus 3. And so I want to think about what happens in this region, say, if we're doing high energy scattering like I sketched earlier. And in this strong gravity region, we can first think perturbatively. So we're thinking, again, about these large impact parameters out near the Schwarzschild radius. And you reach the impact parameter corresponding to the Schwarzschild radius when you have scattering at an angle of order 1. You know that if you have a particle flying near to the horizon of a black hole, it will deflect a lot. And in this regime, correspondingly, Q over E is of order 1, and our corrections were down in Q over E. So we have to worry about subleading corrections. And in fact, there are subleading loop diagrams that we haven't considered up till now. Here's just one of those. And so we get an expansion in the Schwarzschild radius over the impact parameter, over the distance, in powers. And in fact, we saw this precisely when we looked carefully at the supergravity amplitudes. And near the impact parameter corresponding to the Schwarzschild radius, of course, these terms are not small. In fact, this series looks divergent when you reach this regime of scattering angle of order 1 or impact parameter of order of the Schwarzschild radius. And one can even sharpen that up a little bit further by referring back to a calculation done by Duff back in the 70s, he showed that if you take a massive point source and sum up the graviton tree diagrams, these are supposed to be gravitons, in a series very much like this, then summing up that set of diagrams gives you precisely the Schwarzschild metric as a perturbation about flat space. And of course, that diverges at the Schwarzschild radius. A rough way of saying that is a black hole is a large perturbation of flat space. And so we expect that likewise here, the correct way of thinking about this, these higher order terms is to sum up the tree diagrams attaching the energetic sources, and those should give you the collision geometry also in this high energy context. And this collision geometry was shown back in 2002. If you collide two particles at ultra high energies, that forms a horizon, aka a black hole. And so our metric that we should be perturbing about in order to avoid this basically the divergence in the perturbation series about flat space should be the classical metric of a black hole. So the idea is that's the right way to attack this problem of very high energy scattering. But here we encounter more trouble, coming back to the unitarity problem. Hawking showed in his famous calculation that a perturbative quantization of fields about this geometry, or any geometry where you form a black hole that settles down and then Hawking evaporates, leads to a loss of information and therefore a lack of unitarity. In fact, it's worse than that, because if you think about this carefully, you encounter what has been called a paradox, the black hole information paradox. So I'm going to give a lightning review of that very quickly. So you form a black hole in high energy scattering or in some other process, and it will evaporate. And roughly speaking, that is a process that is pair production at the horizon, where here, say, we're thinking about production of a black hole in the collision of an electron and a positron. Here's the horizon is a dotted line and the singularity. And so you have pair production out near the horizon with one partner of the pair escaping and the other going into the singularity. That's the usual Eddington-Finkelstein representation of it, and you can also draw a Penrose diagram, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with those, which illustrates the same basic feature as pair production near the horizon with one partner making it out to infinity. So to come back to the paradox, what's wrong with this picture? Well, we can draw some slices here, which we'll call nice slices, which are spatial slices which avoid strong curvature, and they don't have strong extrinsic curvature as well. So nice slices in both pictures. And if we consider the state on such a slice, we can update Hawking's argument and make it a little bit sharper and see where the real trouble is. So I've reproduced the picture from the previous slide. And just by locality, you know that the state on this slice should consist of, like this kind of state where you have an independent Hilbert space for the outside particles and for the inside particles, say. And then, of course, you have correlations between those two. And the general state is something of that kind of form. And then if you're just interested in the outside description of the process, you take that so-called nice slice state and you should trace over the degrees of freedom in the inside Hilbert space to form a density matrix. And so that's what I'm doing on this line. And that density matrix is not something that corresponds to a pure state. It has an entropy, and we can calculate that entropy using von Neumann's famous formula, minus trace of rho log rho. And if you count up the entropy in Hawking particles coming out as a function of, say, retarded time, or the time you've observed the black hole, basically, it increases to a quantity of order the area of the black hole in Planck units by the time that the black hole fully evaporates down. And in fact, this calculation is insensitive to what you throw in. We could throw in my laptop, which has a fair amount of information, and it doesn't change this story. So we have pure states evolving to mixed states. And the problem with, well, and so in fact, that led to Hawking's proposal that information is just fundamentally lost in gravity. And actually, he proposed that there's a new evolution law, not linear evolution on states, but evolution on density matrices via what was called the dollar matrix. But the problem with this is that quantum mechanics is really a remarkably robust framework. The basic idea is that information transfer requires energy, as you know. And so if you're losing information, you're, in effect, losing energy. And once you've allowed that kind of thing to happen, it can happen all the time in virtual processes and contaminate all of physics and lead to massive energy non-conservation. And this was the basic idea behind an argument made by Banks, Peskin, and Susskind that Hawking's non-unitarity leads to an effective thermal ensemble, say, in this room that would be of order the Planck temperature just through these virtual effects. So that clearly is in severe conflict with experience and cannot be right. So to summarize so far, we've said that by locality, there's no information escape during evaporation. You have these correlated pairs, and there's no way this pair can suddenly reappear outside the black hole, or this partner of the pair. And by energy conservation and quantum mechanics, information is conserved. So the obvious out to the story is, well, we wait for the black hole to completely evaporate down, shrink down to the Planck size, and then the information escapes. But there's a problem with this as well. Once it reaches the Planck size, that's how much energy you have left, and this is how much information you have to get out of order the area in Planck units or the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. It's a huge quantity. And to relay that amount of information with a small energy takes a very, very long time. So you end up with something that is a remnant no matter what, which is either long-lived or perhaps even stable. And here we're into a serious, we're finally painted into a corner, a very serious corner, because you could have started with an arbitrarily large black hole and then correspondingly, you must have an infinite number of these different kinds of remnants to encode all possible information from an arbitrarily large black hole. But if you really have infinite species of these remnants, then in generic quantum processes, they will be infinitely produced. They may have a very small amplitude to be produced, a given state in a given process, but that small amplitude gets multiplied by this infinity. And so that can be sharpened up, but that's the essence of what's been called the paradox. Information can't get out, it can't be lost, and it can't be left behind. So what do we do? Well, this paradox has been, we can recognize, actually, as a conflict between some of our very basic principles of physics, quantum mechanics, locality on the macroscopic scale, and basically Lorentz or diffeomorphism invariance, which is sort of local Lorentz invariance on macroscopic scales. And these are the cornerstones of this magnificent edifice called local quantum field theory, which seemingly describes all of physics we've observed so far, but apparently this edifice has this little crack in it. So what do we do about that? And in particular, you know, which of these principles need to be sacrificed? Well, maybe all of them, but let's be conservative and try to do the least damage possible. Quantum mechanics and Lorentz invariance are pretty hard to sensibly modify, respecting consistency in observation. And it seems that a real weak point here, in fact, is locality, rather than these other two things. And so, in my mind, there are good indications, and I think others as well, that there's a breakdown or modification of locality on macroscopic scales with respect to this semi-classical picture. In macroscopic scales, because it has to operate to transfer information, so to speak, from deep inside a black hole, a macroscopic black hole, to outside, and that's a macroscopic scale. In fact, Page gave very basic information theoretic arguments that in order to have unitary evolution, to not destroy quantum mechanics, information has to start leaking out on this timescale of order, the Schwarzschild radius times the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, where the black hole has evaporated to, say, half of its original size, but is still macroscopic. So we really are talking about a macroscopic issue, long-distance issue. Well, what do our candidate theories say? We have various candidate theories for quantum gravity. loop quantum gravity, for example, you could ask, and it's still working to recover flat space and scattering of perturbations about it. A modest first goal would be to derive the Born and Iconal amplitudes, which I've talked about. Now, a general concern is that it doesn't have a clear mechanism for such sort of large-scale non-locality. It certainly modifies locality at distances comparable to the Planck scale, but very long-distance scales, apparently, the idea is it would correspond to a description very much like our usual continuum local descriptions we have in field theory. What about string theory? Well, string theory apparently has some of the relevant features. It's got a sort of non-locality in extendedness. Also, one can perturbatively calculate the S matrix, and string theory regulates the infinities in such a perturbative calculation. And also, there are these so-called dualities, like ADS-CFT and the idea of holography. So it looks pretty suggestive that string theory can really attack this set of problems I've outlined. But not so fast. We really should understand how strings tackle, in particular, this unitarity problem, and let's critically assess that. So first of all, if you look carefully, there's no clear role for this extendedness of strings in recovering the information. There had been suggestions that that might be part of the story, but you find when you consider high energy scattering that basically the time to excite extended strings is different from the time for forming a black hole, and string theory doesn't clearly give you a mechanism to get information from inside that black hole to outside in the Hawking radiation, at least so far as we can tell, and we've looked at this in some detail. Moreover, you say, well, string theory gives us perturbative finiteness, but as I've emphasized, the perturbation series appears to diverge in this regime, just as in any other theory of gravity. In fact, this basic feature of momentum fractionation tells you that, in some sense, excitation of the string is not playing an important role in modifying the perturbation series in this regime. We still have the same infinity when we try to sum up the terms. Well, what about non-perturbative approaches like ADS-CFT? Well, so far, we don't understand how to get out in detail local observables inside the bulk of ADS, and so we don't directly address the paradox, which involves thinking about, say, the state inside a black hole and the nice slice argument and so on. And you, however, might say, well, at least this gives you an approach to computing the S matrix, so that should be good enough. But in fact, it's not clear that ADS-CFT reproduces a sufficiently fine-grained S matrix for bulk physics. This is a very important problem for string theory, is to try to understand how you extract the basically the bulk or flat space S matrix in the large ADS radius limit from the boundary theory. And so here are some references on that. That would be a whole other talk. So it's not clear exactly how string theory does solve the unitarity problem in detail. And I'm going to at least propose that we should take a broader viewpoint. We need to understand the basic principles and mechanisms of, you know, some consistent unitary gravitational mechanics or theory, whether or not it's strings. And this really does appear to present some profound conceptual challenges. So, in fact, I'd like to illustrate that by reminding you of some history. We have faced a seemingly, in my mind, similar crisis in physics around 100 years ago with the problem of the classical instability of the atom. And from the point of view of a classical physicist, you might have said, well, classical physics breaks down when the electron spirals into the nucleus, and so we should just be tinkering with the laws of classical physics down at those scales. But of course, that's completely wrong. We learned that the answer involves the Bohr radius, a much larger distance scale, and quantum mechanics just takes over there, and classical mechanics is completely irrelevant inside the Bohr radius. So new physics was needed together with new principles and mechanisms. And it seems to me that a plausible analogy replaces this story with a black hole. You know, people focus on local quantum field theory and ultraviolet singularities and ultraviolet divergences and singularities, very short distance issues. But we seem to have some very serious problems out at the scale of the Schwarzschild radius of, say, a black hole. And at least that suggests that some aspect of quantum gravity takes over here, perhaps involving a more subtle breakdown of local quantum field theory than we see here. And that involves some new physics, and the big question is, what kind of form can that physics take? So I'm suggesting that the classical instability paradox has a modern analog in the black hole information paradox. It's a fundamental paradox that we really need to face up to, and suggests the need for new principles, or perhaps finding such principles in existing theory, but we ought to understand how they work. But in any case, this seems to be a very important guide. Well, so how can we approach this set of, or this issue, this basic issue, and its various facets? Well, we can try to understand better where Hawking went wrong. What was wrong with the nice slice argument, and what do we need to do about it? We can think in analogy with quantum mechanics about, say, parameterizing the correspondence boundary. Where is local quantum field theory valid, and where isn't it? And obviously, there should be a long distance regime where you're encountering limitations to local quantum field theory. You can think about properties of the gravitational S matrix. As I've emphasized, that's how string theory, in fact, was invented, that kind of approach. You can try to probe locality in various ways. A big question here is, how can you even imagine a framework which yields the approximate locality of quantum field theory, which, of course, is very, very well tested, yet has the needed non-locality in the black hole context to give us a unitary story? And finally, you can investigate related issues in cosmology. There, of course, we have at least some more experimental guidance at present. So I've been working on various of these issues with collaborators, and we'll briefly talk about some aspects of them, very briefly. An important hint, I think, is where local quantum field theory is modified. What is this correspondence boundary? And there are various proposals that one can distill from things said over time. You know, the usual guess is that local quantum field theory breaks down when curvatures reach the Planck scale. Another idea is the so-called string uncertainty principle, that there's an extra term in the uncertainty principle corresponding to the growth of strings with energy. Other people think about modified dispersion relations, which would correspond to sort of a correspondence at, well, sufficiently high momentum, we should think about new physics. There are also, say, information bounds and so on. These are single particle bounds. These are multi-particle. But let's just compare a little bit more sharply the story with quantum mechanics versus classical mechanics and our current situation. So in that earlier story, the dynamical description of a system involves basically phase space, positions in momenta. And we know that's valid as long as you respect this bound coming from the uncertainty principle. So what are the dynamical configurations in quantum field theory on a curved background, say, in general relativity? They're Fock space states. Say, here's a two-particle Fock space state. Let's think in particular about one corresponding to some minimum uncertainty wave packets with approximate positions and momenta, approximately definite positions and momenta. So when is this kind of two-particle state not a good description? Well, clearly, if we look at separations between these two particles that are small as compared to their center of mass energy, then this whole picture of Fock space states becomes extremely suspicious. So the idea is we'd better respect this bound to be talking about the usual field theory description. Notice I'm not phrasing this as a single particle bound because it's hard to implement this kind of story with single particles, say, with the shortest distance. And the issue with that is the shortest distance is not compatible with Lorentz invariance. You boost it and it becomes shorter. So this is one idea for where the correspondence boundary could lie. It's what we've called the locality bound, and there are various generalizations of this. Turning to another theme, you can ask about where Hawking went wrong, and is there really sharply a paradox? And so again, the logic in a nutshell is you compute the state on this slice, and that gives you the density matrix, and that density matrix has an entropy which describes the missing information. So is that really a precise calculation, or is there something potentially wrong with it? That's the question. And in fact, if you think about how you compute this state on this nice slice, Well, first of all, it's a rather extreme kind of object. The time scale here from, say, the formation of the black hole to when the information should start coming out is very, very long. It's of order of the evaporation time of the black hole. And so you have this this extended slice which you're keeping from falling into the singularity. It's a very artificial construct. And it's not clear that the state on that slice is really a physically meaningful object. In fact, if you try to give a gauge invariant description, you run into the kinds of problems we've already alluded to, and which we'll come back to. And also, if you try to perturbatively evaluate the state on this slice, you encounter apparent sources for large fluctuations if you go to sufficiently long time. So there's some discussion in these references here. So a proposed outline of a resolution of the paradox is that the semi-classical or perturbative nice slice picture is not an accurate representation of the detailed quantum state of a black hole. And certainly, if there is no such sharp argument based on that for information loss, we don't have a paradox. But of course, a failure of a perturbative description of the nice slice state would indicate that we need some non-perturbative completion in order to say what's going on with black hole evolution. So there's certainly an information problem involving what is that non-perturbative dynamics that ultimately gives us unitary scattering. Well, so we want to sharpen our understanding of the issues with this local perturbative description of the black hole state and how local quantum field theory might be modified. And one, I think, good way of doing that is with this analogy. If you think about evolution on these nice slices through a black hole, that picture is a lot like evolution on spatial slices in De Sitter space. Here I've drawn the Penrose diagram of De Sitter space. I've got a kind of funny way of drawing it. But these are supposed to be global, time slices in the global slicing. So this problem is a toy model for that problem. And evolution on these slices in particular is a toy model for thinking about evolution on these slices through a black hole geometry. And the De Sitter story, in fact, is much simpler. And we encounter some parallel problems in De Sitter or more general inflationary cosmologies. For example, what is the well-defined gauge invariant description of the state, the quantum wave function of the universe? How do we make gauge invariant statements? And also, there are large effects of fluctuations at long times. And in fact, that's the topic of the conference, infrared issues and loops in De Sitter space. And so the idea is we really ought to understand these problems here, well, for independent reasons, but also as a toy model for the black hole problem. The independent reasons, of course, in the De Sitter and an inflationary case involve experiment. So I'm not going to give references, but I'll, in the remaining time, give some brief description of at least some of my viewpoints on this story. And for more references on this whole story, there are many of the experts on this subject speaking at the conference, and you should look at their talks. So first, a quick discussion of observables. How do we locally characterize the state? And in quantum field theory, we ordinarily say just draw a space-like slice, and we describe the state in terms of these local observables, say the scalar field at a position with coordinates x. But as I've mentioned already, this is not a gauge invariant statement, because if you perform a coordinate transformation or a diffeomorphism, then such a local operator will change, so it's gauge variant. It's not gauge invariant. The remedy to this, really in spirit, was already suggested back in ancient times by Leibniz, and certainly Einstein espoused such ideas, and DeWitt, and so on. The idea is that really we should figure out how to think relationally. And what I mean by that is, instead of describing the location of this at some abstract coordinate point, we should describe the location of this excitation with respect to some other feature in our state, like planet Earth or some other, say, macroscopic object, or you could try to think about the limitations of this viewpoint when you take your reference backgrounds to not be macroscopic. And in fact, semi-classically, this is exactly the kind of thing that is done in studies of inflation. For example, we refer observables in inflation to the reheating time, a certain time when the scalar field, say, hits a given value. And what one would like to understand is how to implement this in a consistent quantum framework, not, you know, really working semi-classically. And we've at least made some steps towards a proposed implementation in the quantum field theory approximation, that at least diffeomorphism invariant objects you can write down involve, say, the observable that you're trying to measure, a local, say, field. And then you also need some kind of reference field, a background field, like the field describing, say, the location of planet Earth, crudely speaking. I'm clearly using an analogy there. So this is an idea that you can get these specific kinds of relational observables, proto-local observables, we called them. And in certain circumstances, they will reduce to local observables that are familiar in field theory. So again, I've sketched out the basic kind of construction. And just to amplify on the idea, so in certain states where the background, this field here, is sharply localized, we can get our local observable O that we're after in an approximation, you know, localized near a point where our background is say, sharply peaked. In this sense, localization really is an emergent quantity. If we think about the abstract structure of the theory, we have these observables, and we only have local observables arising in certain states in an approximation, and they aren't really necessarily a fundamental part of the theory to begin with. And in fact, this can be a bad approximation if your background field, say, is fluctuating strongly, your reference field, or you have some other large back reaction effects, like associated with this locality bound, then it seems clear that this kind of construction should fail. In fact, we can do a quick and interesting estimate for the black hole. If we want such a reference background for describing the state on a nice slice through a black hole geometry, you can ask when would its back reaction on the geometry of the black hole be important. Now, the energy of the Hawking quanta coming out are of order, the energies are of order 1 over r. So that's going to be the minimum energy of a reference, say, detector that is supposed to be registering the state on this slice. These pair or partners that go into the black hole also have a characteristic scale given by 1 over r. And so you can ask, if that's the minimum energy of these registers, when is the back reaction due to, say, a collection of registers important? And that certainly is going to happen by the time the mass of those registers, the total mass, is of order the mass of the black hole. And just from the energy per register and the total mass, you find the number of registers. So basically, you will have an important back reaction if you try to register MR quanta, and that's of order the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole. So a corresponding time scale is corresponding to emitting that many quanta is this page time of order the black hole entropy times the Schwarzschild radius of the black hole. Incidentally, there are also issues, we'll mention some of them, for de Sitter space after such times. That's a time scale that seems to come out in that story, and we've said a little bit more about that in this paper. So coming back to the cosmological context, let's turn not just to the background question, but more generally to this fluctuation problem, which certainly relates to this business of finding reference backgrounds. And an apparent basic point in this whole story is that in inflationary cosmology, effects of small fluctuations can build up to become important at long times. And you see this via large infrared contributions that you find in calculations explicitly, which are being talked about in this conference. There's a range of interpretations about what this means. In fact, there's clearly controversy exhibited at this conference. The story ranges from statements that there are no practical physical consequences due to these, to the statement that there are large corrections to certain quantities, to even more extreme statements, for example, that the cosmological constant decays as a result of this basic kind of story. So again, I'm giving my own perspective, which is not universally shared, I know, but in my view, this seems more the correct story. First, let's, however, address the question of whether these effects really are physical, a buildup of fluctuations leading to important sort of infrared consequences. And certainly there is a context where they are physical, they lead to important consequences, and that is in the context of self-reproduction. You probably have some familiarity with this story. If you have a scalar field with a very shallow potential, then you can fluctuate up as fast as you roll down, if the potential is shallow enough. And that leads to this famous picture that Linde draws all the time, where you have different regions with very different effective cosmological constants. This is somewhat of a cartoon. But the bottom line is that the accumulated effect of the fluctuations becomes quite large over long times. So this is one example of what I've said, and the question is, how general is this story? Well, first let's examine it more closely. The essential mechanism for this growth is exhibited, let's think about De Sitter space, so it's exhibited through studying fluctuations therein. Let's think about light or massless fields, and basically we have production of pairs a little bit like the Hawking effect, very much like the Hawking effect, and the scales here are, well, a radius corresponding to 1 over h, the Hubble constant, or, well, it's not exactly constant, but anyway, that's the Hubble radius. And so these fluctuations leave the horizon, or the horizon scale, and they freeze and they accumulate. They build up and, in fact, can start behaving quite classically. You see this explicitly when you compute, say, the two-point function for a scalar field, a massless scalar field, let's say, in the De Sitter geometry, and you get something that has both the usual ultraviolet divergence that you can have, but you also get this extra term in the expanding geometry, and you find that by expanding out in terms of the mode functions of the field and so on, simple quantum field theory calculation. This term diverges at small wave number and is a prototypical infrared divergence that you encounter all over the place in this story. In fact, you encounter this kind of infrared divergence when you think about other light fields, like, of course, gravity is a specifically relevant light field. You can consider gravitational perturbations of the Schwarzschild, or sorry, of the De Sitter metric. Let's work in, say, transverse traceless gauge. And if you look at the two-point function of the graviton, you get the same kind of expression. In fact, it's exactly the same up to a factor of 2 if you take a certain trace for this growing, well, or at least naively, infrared divergent quantity. So the question is, what really makes this quantity finite? What's the physics here? How is it regulated? Well, one approach to regulating these divergences is to introduce a mass. Let's think about a small mass, and then actually the growth in the two-point function saturates. It doesn't grow beyond this value as you go to infinite times. Another way, you know, obviously this isn't going to work for gravity, since that, roughly speaking, violates the gauge symmetry. Another way to think about what regulates this infrared divergence is that you start inflation at some certain time, and so you have a finite duration of inflation, and that gives you a longest wavelength for which you're talking about this formula, and that regulates the divergence, and you get an expression then that grows with the duration of inflation beginning at that time. So the Hubble scale times the initial time when inflation turned on is effectively acting as your infrared regulator. But you still have effects that grow with time, and so even though they're not infrared divergent, that's a potential concern. And in fact, this basic effect is what drives self-reproduction, and you can ask how broadly relevant it is. So in general, you might imagine that growth of some field can make important contributions if, well, first of all, it's an observable. Certainly then that would make important contributions if it becomes, if the fluctuations of it become strong. But alternatively, if the field has an indirect effect on other fields that's important through interactions. So using a different language, which was introduced by Wilczek to describe how hidden sector physics or dark matter physics interacts with visible physics, we need something like a portal for these fluctuations to become visible to us. And in the context of self-reproduction, so it's the, say, scalar inflaton field that's fluctuating, which gives you ultimately a large correction to the potential, and that has a large back reaction on the metric, and that's why you get this cartoon, or at least this diagram represented by the cartoon that I showed you of Lindes. Now, this is particularly tricky to discuss given the questions of gauge invariance or formulating gauge invariant observables. One possible test of this whole story is to, for example, think about loop contributions due to these fluctuations, and there will be more on this in the talk by my collaborator Sloth. Just to say a couple of words about that, first of all, we can evaluate the leading infrared or long time effects via so-called semi-classical methods, and then check with a full quantum calculation. And we do indeed find, for certain quantities, large such contributions. For example, you can look at corrections to the two-point function due to loops. And in fact, a simpler story is just if you forget about gravity and include self-interactions of scalar fields. And here you do see large infrared loop contributions in stories told primarily by others. In the context of gravity, if you include the effect of these fluctuations represented through these gravitational loops, you also get large contributions at long times. And let me just advertise, we've at least introduced a new way of, I think, of writing down the rules for NN perturbation theory, which streamlines such calculations somewhat. These are, in fact, hard calculations to do, but one can do them explicitly as well as check them using our semi-classical methods. So if we apply this story, for example, to slow roll inflation, where we have a non-trivial scale factor field here, you can look at the two-point function of that, and you get these loop corrections, which basically involve this growing two-point function, both from the scalar fluctuations and the tensor fluctuations. And those can give large shifts to, in principle, observable quantities, like tensor to scalar ratios and so on. And you can ask when these loop corrections become large, and basically they become large when these effects are of order 1, so very roughly when, say, the two-point function of the graviton is of order h cubed t, and the time scale there, then, is 1 over h cubed, and that, of course, is the same kind of time scale we've seen before. In general dimension, it's a time scale of order the Hubble radius times the entropy of de Sitter space. And so here you have at least an apparent breakdown of perturbation theory when loop corrections become large. And a question being examined at this conference is how exactly to interpret that. And proposed outlines of a story are the following, that perturbation theory indeed breaks down for the purposes of computing the full state, the quantum wave function in the entire inflated volume at sufficiently long times, what one might refer to as the large box. There you do have apparently large infrared corrections. But in computing more local quantities in, so to speak, a small box that might correspond to, say, our observable universe, it appears that you can, in at least simple cases, absorb the large corrections into a definition of the background, say, metric and other fields. In fact, we can illustrate this basic picture with the story of self-reproduction. Here's a better picture than the cartoon I showed you. This is from an actual simulation. So you get these regions where you have very different values of the scalar field after evolving in self-reproduction. And you might focus on just one little patch here where the scalar field takes on some value and then zoom in on it and look at small fluctuations around that. And so if you ask questions relevant to, say, the local structure of the state in the vicinity of that point, then you expect to absorb the effect of all these other fluctuations just in the value of the scalar field there. So local questions don't depend on all this junk. But if you ask about the global properties of the state, then you really have to take into account the fluctuations on the large scales, which can become large. And in fact, if perturbation theory is breaking down for evaluating the state of the whole system, and we can't calculate that full quantum wave function of the universe, there's a very important question of what we should be doing about this. So the basic idea here is that one observer's fluctuation is another observer's background. It depends on the scale on which you look at things. This is also true for these tensor fluctuations that I've already talked about, true fluctuations in the gravitational degrees of freedom, which also grow to get quite large over large scales with time. They build up. And this is sort of a space-time foam writ large. And there are methods to, in principle, measure this that may ultimately turn into in practice methods where we can actually see the effects of these fluctuations. So a plausible story is that for local observables, or approximately local observables, we can resum and eliminate the large effects by zooming in on a region where we can ignore the very long wavelength fluctuations, at least in simple circumstances. But globally, it doesn't look like you can do that. And in fact, with the tensor fluctuations, it looks like, well, or more generally, it looks like there's a potential instability of a sort of de Sitter space, although it's not clear, at least to me, that this is a true instability, which is suppressing the cosmological constant. In characterizing these tensor fluctuations, you might ask, what are the correct gauge invariant observables? And just a quick note on that, there are discussions of how to characterize self-reproduction in terms of things that are close to gauge invariant, say the total volume. Since these tensor fluctuations are volume preserving, you need other kinds of quantities besides the total volume. One possibility is line integrals of, say, along curves around, well, if you think about a toroidal universe or a curve between massive co-moving objects, that's at least one approach to formulating gauge invariant things. Okay, so there is this, and there are various other broader questions, and I'll just finish there with some of the questions we have. Of course, we'd like to check and refine this story of infrared perturbations in de Sitter space and really understand if, say, they have a more important impact, like making the cosmological constant disappear, or whether somehow they aren't relevant when you ask the correct question. But again, I've said what I think how I view things. And moreover, I think this is an important issue of principle. If there's no perturbative calculation of the quantum state of the universe, even if we can't observe it with Planck, that's an in principle important problem. How do we calculate something like the quantum state of the universe if perturbation theory is breaking down? And so that suggests we need some non-perturbative completion of gravity. And of course, that story I'm particularly interested in because it has this analog in the black hole case where, in order to sort of get into this so-called paradox, you're doing something very similar. You're calculating the state on this, in the background of the black hole, so to speak. So that brings us to the last question. How sharp are the parallels with the black hole story that, for example, the suggestion that there's no perturbative nice slice state and that's how you avoid the paradox? Now, as I mentioned, avoiding the paradox isn't good enough. We really need to, if we want to say we have a complete theory of quantum gravity, we need to have some calculational framework to tell us what is the result of scattering two particles at very high energies and then watching the resulting black hole evaporate. We need to be able to calculate that process. And in order to do that, if perturbation theory is, you know, truly failing at these long distance scales, we need some non-perturbative completion of it that unitarizes the theory and appears to not have the basic properties of locality that we might naively expect. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
have some time for questions. We'll need to use these microphones because so the questions can be recorded and so everyone else can hear them. Questions.
Did you really mean breakdown of the sitter or just large effects on after the end of inflation? Because breakdown of the sitter, even though it's not a compensation of the cosmological constant, seems to be a very strong statement, right? And
potentially, and then the question is how do you physically characterize such a breakdown? But it appears that, say if you have de Sitter that you modify by starting at, say, some finite time, but then it's de Sitter for the future, that you just have a cosmological constant, you do have this buildup of the tensor fluctuations. And while you might not be able to observe their effects locally, particularly if you think about resumming things into a background for the local observers, globally you have this large sort of gas of gravitons that has built up and has this large variance. So the question is how to interpret that, and that at least suggests that there are important quantum effects that correspond to a large departure from the classical geometry, is one way of saying it, but not necessarily, at least in my view, a zeroing of the cosmological constant, but other people might argue differently.
Yeah, so you mentioned the page time for the sitter space.
Yes.
Did you try to suggest that it is the time by which the sitter will decay, or you tried to say something else?
That is the kind of time scale on which we see buildup of, say, important loop corrections, which suggest a failure of the perturbative expansion. And so then the question becomes, is that us making a mistake, or is that real physics? And so that gets you into this whole resummation story. And so the suggestion is that this resummation story is a way to sort of absorb those large effects for the purposes of describing local observations, say in the small box, but that will not suffice to avoid the problem with perturbation theory if you're trying to describe the state in the entire inflated volume. That's the suggestion, I think there are some things that support that. But that indeed, you do have some breakdown of perturbation theory on that time scale for purposes of describing certain quantities, say the wave function of the universe, if you actually want to calculate that.
I missed a point in the argument you were making against the variable that some Italian person, I think it was Cremolini, or perhaps I'm mispronouncing his name, suggested, which was the integral along a surface of constant time of the three volume. Mm-hmm. You said that that the gravitons would not contribute to that. Are you only including the effect of the gravitons themselves and not their effect on the zeta?
Let's think of that statement just to lowest order of perturbation theory, and let's think of that statement say not about some generic slow roll inflation, but just about de Sitter for simplicity. And there, the transverse traceless perturbations to leading order don't change the volume.
Right, but if you included what they would do to the effective A of T, then there would be an effect, presumably, right?
There's a question of whether there's a big effect.
Yeah, maybe it might be zero, but.
Or it might be small, but there are higher order effects.
Okay,
and then
good.
Question is, what do they do? But at least this is a way of getting at the leading order effect, I think, is, for example, by considering line integrals, distances as opposed to volumes, because, think of it, it's analogous to what you do with LIGO. How do you measure a gravitational wave? Well, you have these, masses arranged, and you have a gravitational wave fly past them, and you change the lengths between them. So that's what we should be doing in this context, is measuring, or at least thinking in principle about observables that measure these large-scale fluctuations of the tensors.
You mentioned the issue of the linkage between unitarity and renormalizability. Now, there's a strong linkage in electroweak theory.
In what theory?
Electroweak.
Yes.
Because the www gets violated.
Yeah, that's what I was alluding to.
Because since it's renormalizable with the Higgs exchange, you kill that. Anyway, with gravity, if you make gravity renormalizable with an R-squared theory, higher-order theory, you violate unitarity. So there is a strong linkage. I do believe there is a strong linkage with gravity. One or the other would go, or both.
Well, I think I've exhibited, at least if I managed to communicate that, and by the way, apologies if I'm not completely coherent. I got stuck on a red-eye flight last night as a result of a flight snafu. But I think there's, the story I told illustrates that you can separate the problem of unitarity in gravity, or at least there is a separation, from the probability of the problem of non-renormalizability or other short distance issues. And you particularly clearly see that when you consider this ultra high energy scattering, say, thought experiment. There, and I gave various detailed arguments, there you have a problem that is seemingly largely insensitive to short distance issues. And moreover, you encounter a critical challenge to unitarity, the whole Hawking story and the information paradox story. You encounter this challenge just by discussing the long-distance features of the state. And moreover, you can't even imagine any short-distance modification that fixes it. So in that sense, you really seem to have a separation between the unitarity problem. And in a way, it's a different kind of unitarity problem in gravity than, or at least it has a different manifestation than in electroweak theory. But you really do seem to have a separation between the unitarity problem, which apparently involves essentially long-distance physics, and the non-renormalizability problem, which basically involves, how do you correct the short-distance physics or regulate the short-distance physics.
So as I understood the first part of your talk, Steve, this unitarity problem you just referred to again is occurring at distances of the order of the horizon.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, so I agree with that. That makes sense. What I don't quite see is how that fits with the second part of the story, where you identified this completely different scale where perturbation theory breaks down. Are these two completely different physical effects? Or are they related?
You mean you're talking about both in the black hole context?
Well.
Say. We could give either the de Sitter or the black hole.
Yeah, let's talk about de Sitter because the other case was a little clearer to me. The de Sitter.
Well,
you have the scale 1 over
HQ. Let me start with black hole and we can try to rephrase in de Sitter. So just sticking with the black hole context. So we only really, say, see that we have a problem if we look at things at very long times. So it's certainly true that, for unitary evolution, we apparently need a means to get the information from deep inside the black hole out to the outgoing Hawking radiation, so to speak. So that's over macroscopic distances of order of the horizon radius. But that doesn't have to happen, so to speak, immediately when a black hole forms. You need that to happen for unitary evolution on these very long timescales. So if it is due to some, say, non-local modification of gravity, that doesn't have to have important contributions at horizon radius scales at short times. And in my view, that would be a more sort of radical proposal. But you do apparently need important effects to modify the local story at those macroscopic scales, at least over these very long times of order for a four-dimensional black hole of order the radius cubed.
Okay,
time
that's
scale.
Bringing in the information paradox, which is a lot of other points.
But well, no, that's the unitary problem. That's what you were asking.
Question about the gravitational scattering.
Yes.
That you've discussed first.
Yeah.
Does that or does that not break down at an impact parameter scale associated with the horizon? GM rather than something which is much longer.
Well, okay. So
that's a specific question, right? That's
yeah.
nothing to do with her, with
well, there,
information paradox.
Yeah, but it's a problem that intrinsically has two timescales. Let me phrase it this way. Let's think about the physics. You have two particles, they come in, they make a black hole, and if you're looking at the S matrix, you'd better wait until you get the asymptotic products of that black hole, which is the Hawking radiation. And that takes a time scale of order R cubed, or M cubed, to come out, say if we're thinking about in four dimensions. So the characteristic time scales for discussing the S matrix, unitarity, and so on, in some sense are, well, the characteristic scales are the radius of the black hole, but also this very long time scale, which you need to even be talking about the S matrix.
Okay. Let's talk about it later. I don't quite get it.
Okay.
Well, before we speak, let me just remind the conference participants that there's the photograph outside. You can go this way and follow those. So let's thank Steve for a wonderful colloquium.